it's Hannah Gelbart, and this is What in the World from the BBC World Service. We're the podcast that explains what in the world is going on. This is Delhi. We're outside India's top court, where excited crowds have been waiting for hours. Five judges are about to announce their decision on whether same-sex couples should have the right to marry. People are huddled around mobile phones, listening and waiting for the verdict.
Enter into a union is protected by Part 3 of the Constitution. One second,
everybody. The crowd goes silent. The judges have ruled that the court will not legalise same-sex marriage. Any changes are going to have to be made by politicians instead. It's been a long process. For months, the court's been hearing from people who wanted the law to change. Tens of millions of LGBTQ plus people in India are going to be disappointed with the result. But the government has said it'll now look into giving queer people more rights. So in this episode, we're asking, what does the decision not to legalise same-sex marriage mean for India? So this is actually quite a complicated case, and I have luckily got someone who knows it inside out who's going to talk me through it. Umang Poddar is a BBC correspondent and also a fully trained lawyer in Delhi. Hi, Umang.
Hi, Hannah.
How's your day been so far?
Well, it's been a busy day. I've been up since morning waiting for the judgment, and when the judgment came out, it says it's going to be a really long one. So now we're all here trying to decipher what all it means. Because, like, different judges have taken different opinions on this.
To start off with, can you break this down for me? What have the judges said?
Right. So the top line is that the Supreme Court has refused the right to marry for non-heterosexual couples. And they have said that the government will form a committee to decide, like, what kind of rights could be given without bringing them into the ambit of marriage. So now the ball is in the government's court. A lot of people are distraught by the judgment, the kind of rights they were hoping to get through the judgment they haven't got. But at the same time, there was a very strong opposition from the government, from different religious leaders here in India, who were staunchly against the idea of same-sex or any sort of queer marriages. They have said that the court has done the right thing, where they have asked the government to now look into this and decide on this in the future.
How likely is it that these rules might change?
Right. So as of now, it seems very unlikely. The government went as far as to say that how this was an urban elitist concept which did not affect most of the country, and therefore this was a petition by a select few people. And second, that how marriage is based on a lot of religious and cultural ethos, which will be substantially diluted if you start introducing other forms of relationships, anything but heterosexual marriages. So it seems like the government will not allow them to marry. Though the government has said that they'll form a committee and look at, like, what could be given to them, for example, medical benefits, provident fund and other things. So while the government might be open to giving them rights in some time in the future, but marriage seems to be out of the question for now.
So how have people been reacting? Well, Chayanika Shah was one of the people who actually brought the case to court.
The judgment today has left us disappointed in some ways. In a sense, the five judges together have not given us anything more than what we already had. We will continue to struggle. We will continue to dialogue. We will continue to engage. And this fight shall continue till no one can deny our rights that are due to us.
Zainab Patel is another one of the petitioners.
Irrespective of what the judgment today turned out to be, it is a disappointing day. Of course, because the Supreme Court of India literally abdicated its right to rule in the favor of LGBTIQ Indians, just like any other Indians, from the right to marry. However, the minor gains that have been made by trans people in this judgment, including the possibility of setting up of a cabinet-powered committee to look at the rights within marriage, insurance coverage, property inheritance, etc., we see this as a long but plausible roadway towards realization of civil and political rights. I am determined that the fight will go on irrespective of the roadblocks that are there in front of us.
And this is Anish Gawande. He's the founder of Pink List India, which is a group that tries to persuade politicians to pass laws that give more rights to queer people.
This has been a sobering day. I think there was definitely a sense of cautious optimism this morning before the verdict was pronounced in open court. That's been replaced by a sense of disappointment and anger. The fight for marriage was only the beginning in that quest for equal citizenship, and that being struck down and that right not being recognized is certainly a setback that will take some time to process and many months to ponder over in order to best decide what the way forward is.
So obviously they're quite disappointed, but Umang, if you're gay in India, are there any positives that you can take away from the judgment?
So a couple of things would be there is that all the judges have rejected that notion, which the government had said that this is an urban elitist concept. And apart from that, they've also spoken about like how discrimination can still persist and have talked about how the government should ensure that there's no discrimination, or specifically there's no familial or like natal violence which these couples have to go through. But as we've seen in the past, that court often gives a lot of directives and the government might take some time to like work on them. But still, regardless of the fact, these are still like the fact that the top court in India is saying these things, and nonetheless a 5-judge bench is saying all of these things, that still I think would matter to some extent. Two of the judges have said that there should be something akin to a civil union for same-sex couples. They went as far as to say that there should be a constitutional right for civil unions for queer couples, but how that has to work out, the logistics should be figured out by the government. Apart from that, there were also some other disagreements on whether queer couples can adopt or not, but the majority view is that queer couples won't be able to adopt now after the court's judgment.
We've talked a little bit about rights for trans people, obviously same-sex marriage, adoption. What rights do LGBTQ plus people in India have at the moment?
So very recently, until 2018, being a homosexual would have been a crime in India. So it's only very recent that the court has said that homosexuals won't be criminals. They are technically supposed to have all the rights which any heterosexual person would have. They should not be discriminated against in any place. They also have the right to cohabit, although that cohabitation won't amount to marriage, but still nobody can stop them from choosing their partners, from living together. So broadly, those are the rights which homosexuals or the people from the queer community have right now. And therefore, they were asking for marriage because they said that this is one step forward in terms of us realizing all our rights.
And this has been going on for months, hasn't it? I mean, their court was hearing petitions in April and May, and you've been speaking to people throughout. Who have you been speaking to, and what are they saying?
So, yeah, so recently I spoke to a very interesting person who's a petitioner in the case. She's a 73-year-old lesbian woman who lives in a western state of Gujarat. And she was in a heterosexual marriage for 16 years. But she was saying that how, like, as a child, when she was growing up, she had very deep friendships with women. And she was also intimate with a woman when she was in school. But she was saying that the world is so heterosexual that you can't imagine relationships outside heterosexual relationships. And then she was saying that when she started working with women's rights groups, she realized that how she's meeting different people who are either unhappy in their marriages or they secretly are in love with women. And she said that how slowly when talking to these people, she also started realizing that how she sees problems in the institution of marriage. And despite like how she feels about women, marriage was something which she wouldn't want to be in. And therefore, after being in a marriage for 16 years, after having a son, she decided one day that she doesn't want to be in this institution anymore. And then after that, she fell in love with women and then she started working in the community. So it was very interesting to talk to her, to get to know the perspective of somebody who doesn't believe in marriage themselves, but is still fighting this case because she believes that this can result in people getting a lot of rights and generally the legitimacy to queer relationships, which society isn't giving them right now.
And if nothing else, it has brought the whole issue of LGBTQ plus rights right to the forefront of the national conversation. So more people are aware of it, are aware of the issues that people face on a daily basis. And the conversation hopefully will continue.
Correct. Yeah, I think the fact that we are also talking about this right now is also a testament to the fact that how this case has helped drive public conversation forward. I think this is one of the biggest takeaways which possibly would be there from the judgment. This is, I guess, a part of a journey. And now once the judgment is out, then let's see what people do, if they are filing any appeals or if they are now trying to negotiate with the government about what rights they can get.
Thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
Just before we go, we're going to nip to a quick gig. Festival season is pretty much over, but the conversation around the environmental impact of tours by huge international artists like Coldplay, Beyoncé and Taylor Swift is still going on. I spoke to Jordan Dunbar from the Climate Question podcast about it in an earlier episode.
You've got to move people about. We've got to move our lasers and our fireworks and our DJ sets and our band and our pop star. And then second to that, you need energy, right? To power those lasers and all the fireworks and the amps and the sound, you need to get energy from somewhere. And then third, and this is the biggest emitter, and this really shocked me, it's us, Hannah.
What, the crowd?
Yeah, it's the fans. How we get to and from these concerts. Beyoncé played one of the massive football stadiums in the UK, and it can fit like 80,000 people. So if you do three nights at 80,000 people, that's nearly a quarter of a million people going to and from. If they all drive, that's a lot of car journeys, right?
Yeah, I was pretty surprised to find out that the biggest cause of emissions at gigs and tours is us, the fans. And now a company called AEG Europe says it's found a method to remove all the harmful carbon emissions from concerts. They're going to be using a show by the British band The 1975 at London's O2 Arena next year to pilot what's being called the world's first carbon-removed gig. Bonnie McLaren is a BBC reporter and she's been chatting to the organisers. So what exactly is a carbon-removed gig?
A carbon-removed gig basically means that the carbon dioxide emitted from the show, from staging to fans' travel, is going to be removed from the atmosphere. The harmful greenhouse gas is being removed by a company who are using a variety of methods, including man-made removal, where carbon is taken from the air and stored underground, or more natural methods like planting trees. So the carbon isn't going to be removed by machines at the gig. However, it's worth noting that there is still some controversy around these methods. Scientists say we should be focusing on reducing the amount of carbon dioxide we produce in the first place. But carbon removal could be useful for industries where it's more difficult to reduce emissions, such as agriculture or heavy industry. This is currently a UK-based pilot, but AEG, who run the O2, have told me they plan to roll it out further across tours and venues worldwide if it's successful. Curate, the startup company who are removing the carbon, have also told me that other bands have been in contact about carbon-removed gigs. But it's worth bearing in mind that carbon removal is really expensive. So whether it'll be adopted industry-wide remains to be seen.
Haven't other artists tried to reduce their carbon emissions before? Is this any different?
Lots of artists have made efforts to reduce their emissions on tour. Probably one of the most famous examples are Coldplay, who have done initiatives like planting a tree for every concert goer and had some of the energy for shows created by fans dancing on kinetic dance floors. What's slightly different about the 1975 pilot, though, is that organisers are claiming that all the carbon produced by the gigs is going to be removed from the atmosphere. So in that way, it is slightly different.
Now, the 1975 were in a bit of hot water earlier this year, and the lead singer, Matty Healy, he's a little bit controversial. So some people might say that this is just greenwashing. Is this just a publicity stunt, or have they shown any interest in cutting emissions before?
The 1975 have mentioned the environment before, but their 2020 album, Notes in a Conditional Form, well, that was 22 tracks, but it kicked off with a track which featured climate activist Greta Thunberg. However, this is not really to do with Matty Healy. The band wouldn't provide a comment about these shows, and also they were selected by AEG for the pilot. It wasn't an idea that Matty Healy had himself.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of What in the World from the BBC World Service with me, Hannah Gelbart, and I'm going to be here with the team and with our friends of the pod like Umang every single weekday, Monday to Friday, explaining what in the world is going on.
Yeah, and if you like the episode, I'm sure we'll be bringing to you a lot more stories from India as well. So please subscribe and follow to this wherever you are.
See you next time. Bye.
Bye.